Well, as we begin today, let me open with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, our Heavenly Father, you are heavenly. You are the one who created the heavens and the earth. And we know that the works of creation of yours display your glory, that your eternal power and Godhead are clearly seen by the things that are made, so that all men are without excuse. And I pray, dear Lord, as we think of this general revelation that you have given in your works of creation, that all men live in and see and observe every day, general revelation of you as Creator and the one who has authority over all things, I pray that you'd give us wisdom from Cicero, as he and all of history seems to be the apex, the highest amount of knowledge that one can gain as a fallen, sinful creature. As he himself was a pagan, an idolater, and yet so much of his thinking coincides with reality, the way things really are as you created things to be. I pray that for our generation and our time that you would rebuild our ruins and restore our race. And we know ultimately it is through faith in Christ that you change our hearts and change our minds so that we would indeed willingly submit to your authority in all things. Teach us now, we pray, for your glory and our good. In Christ's precious name, amen. So today we're looking at Cicero and the law of nature a second time. We considered it part one the last time we met. Today is part two. And I want to just, before we get going here, do a little bit of quick review to get our mind thinking about Cicero's time and place in the world. You remember that the founding of Rome by myth and legend was with Romulus in 753 BC. Rome was on the western side of Italy. It was a kingdom governed by kings for about 250 years from 753 to 509 BC. And yet, you could call it an aristocratic monarchy, as we said, since there was a Senate and also an assembly of younger patricians. So a Senate, the idea of senex for old men. So it was the wealthy, wise old men that were in the Senate, and they were involved with legislation. There were checks and balances. In 509 BC, you remember that overnight they formed the Republic by removing the king and replacing the king with two consuls that were elected by the Senate and had been members of the Senate. So it's this aristocracy is what maintains the strength and core of the Roman Republic. It's an aristocratic republic. The Republic, we covered its history from 509 BC, and Cicero, you remember, lived 106 BC to 43 BC. As we're going to end the class today, when Cicero died in 43 BC, the Republic died with him, for they refused to listen to his wisdom. Cicero was a Roman lawyer. He was a statesman and a philosopher. We had mentioned that in 63 BC, he had arisen to the highest position in the Roman Republic. He was a consul, one of those that replaced the king. And they served one-year terms, and he had served 1 year as consul. His life, you remember, was filled with much turmoil. His generation had much conflict, much violence. There was the social war from 90 to 88 BC. There was a seven-year civil war that followed after that. There was a servile war, 73 to 71 BC, led by Spartacus, Roman slave. It was a period of lawfare where you made up litigation against your political opponents. It was a period of assassinations, gang violence, personal exile, and corruption in high places. It resembles our culture today. And therefore, there is certainly, I think, much from Cicero that we can gain for wisdom in our day. Well, Cicero had been exiled after he had been consul. He had made a decision about executing certain people that had a conspiracy against the Republic. He did it under the advice and consent of the Senate when he was consul. But he did it without a trial for those individuals that had conspired against the Republic. And he ended up being exiled by his political opponents who rose to power. A military triumvirate arose that had Crassus and Julius Caesar and Pompey the Great, three military leaders that had kind of taken power. And Pompey the Great ended up having one of the similar enemies of Cicero. And because of that fact, then he was instrumental in bringing Cicero back from exile to help him in that situation. Cicero had led the lawyers against military rule was the problem, and Cicero had traditionally aligned himself with the Senate. Well, because it was Pompey the Great, the military leader who had helped bring Cicero back from exile, it distanced Cicero from the Senate. So he found himself kind of in a desert politically. He turned to writing then in 55 to 51 BC that we had pointed out. He was in his lower 50s in terms of his age. Roughly my age, I'm 54. He wrote his great works on the orator, the Republic, and the laws. And I'm focusing primarily on the Republic and the laws. I mentioned that in my life I had read them here and there in parts, but I read them in whole last month and gleaned quite a few quotes as I've tried to include some on the board for you today, as I did as well last time we met. It was in 54 BC, Cicero wrote a letter to his brother saying, I am writing the political treatise that I mentioned. He wrote in Latin, but the word political was in Greek, because he was signifying that he was writing a ethical treatise. Remember, it was Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Socrates died 399 BC. Plato died 347 BC. Aristotle died 322 BC. All Athens, Greek philosophers, they wrote in Greek. And they were the first ones who wrote political philosophy about the polis, which is under the umbrella of ethics. That we are by nature social creatures in their mind, and they were studying ethical then relationships in the polis, in the city-state. So that's where Socrates is credited as the founder of political philosophy. So in Cicero, writing in Latin to his brother, but used the word political in Greek, he chose a Greek word for political, he's letting his brother know that he was writing a treatise along the lines of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. And as we know, it was the first in Latin, the first in Latin language. It covered moral education, the training of citizens, the best character for a statesman, ethics, as well as the place of a well-run city-state or a well-run political society in the whole cosmic order. He, in his writings, as we said, referred to Greek philosophers. His hero was Plato, and he mentions that a couple of times in his writings. I mentioned that Plato was Socrates' student. After Socrates' death in 399 BC, Plato traveled, and he went to Egypt, and then he went to Italy, southern Italy, to study at the school that had been established by Pythagoras. Pythagoras was a pre-Socratic Greek philosopher who had established his school in southern Italy. Pythagoras died 500 BC. Plato mastered Pythagoras' ideas and theories. All the pre-Socratics were scientists, all the pre-Socratic philosophers in Greece. We covered them. And remember, what was unique about Pythagoras, you've all had in school the Pythagorean theorem, for example. He was a mathematician. And he was one who said, all is number. They believed in an orderly, rational universe. And what was unique about Pythagoras, though, is he was theological and scientific. His religion was called Orphism. And what you find with Cicero is the same thing, this combination of being theological and scientific. Whereas some of the pre-Socratics, like Anaxagoras, who died 428 BC, who said, what's behind the order is mind. What's behind the order of reality is mind. Or Heraclitus, who died in 475 BC, behind the order of things is the Logos. And Heraclitus is the first one that we know of who used the word Logos, that we know from John 1, 1 through 3, that we in Christianity, through the Apostle John, apply it to Christ, that the Logos is personal, the one who created all things and gives order to all things. But Heraclitus was one who regarded the Logos as impersonal, an impersonal force like gravity, but a cause of the order of all things. And you remember Heraclitus is the one who said, of those stepping into rivers staying the same, other and other waters flow. Houses remain houses, rivers remain rivers, dogs remain dogs, but other and other waters flow. There's always change, there's always becoming, but yet there's being. Things in their essence do not change. Houses always remain houses, dogs remain dogs, cats remain cats, rivers remain rivers. But what's the cause behind all of that? And Pythagoras had theology, a divine being behind it. And he died in 500 BC, and I mentioned he set up his school in southern Italy. The Roman Republic was founded 509 BC, and that's where I think Pythagoras' views had much influence within Italy and within the Roman Republic, since Pythagoras died 500 BC, 9 years after the Roman Republic was founded, and he lived in southern Italy. Well, I had mentioned the Roman Republic had won its third battle against Carthage. Carthage was northwest Africa, on the south side of the Mediterranean, south of Sicily. So the island of Sicily was south of Italy. Carthage was their big enemy of the Roman Republic, and they fought three big Punic Wars. And it was after the Third Punic War, 146 BC, remember the Roman Republic salted the earth of Carthage. We don't want them to rise in power again, ever. But it was at that point that the Roman Republic made the fateful decision to go northwest into Western Europe and east across Greece, to Asia Minor, Palestine. And that same year in 146 BC, they plundered Corinth in Greece. Not because they needed to for security, but for plunder, wealth. Remember, there was a 100-year span where the Roman Republic basically fought a war every year. That you either were ready to fight wars and won wars, or you were defeated. And if you were defeated, it was not good. Most women were raped. Most young boys were raped. Taken into slavery. Sometimes all the men were executed. You didn't want to lose a war. So therefore, you wanted to maintain peace through strength. And the Roman Republic did. Every war they were fighting was for security. Except after the Third Punic War, where basically all their main enemies were defeated in 146 BC, and they decided to keep the war machine going. Why? For plunder. For easy wealth. And it's from there onward, things are not good in the Roman Republic. And remember, Cicero then lived 106 to 43 BC during a terrible period. Ethics fell by the wayside. The idea is that for Cicero, the high old Roman virtue, and many scholars talk about that, and we covered several of them, Toynbee, Victor Davis Hanson, Russell Kirk, and Cicero himself, believed that the Roman Republic lasted over 400 years successfully because of its high old Roman virtue. Ethical character was good, by and large. And remember, the idea of a republic, following Plato's thought, is that really what a republic is the human soul writ large. You must have an individual human soul that's well-ordered for a republic to be well-ordered. If you find chaos in the republic, it is a sign that human souls are in chaos. Because we are a self-governed people in a republic, we govern ourselves. And if there is nothing but lawfare, nothing but gang violence, nothing but assassinations, nothing but lying and cheating and stealing, guess what? It's a sign that our human souls are disordered, when the republic itself is full of disorder and chaos. What makes a republic successful and last is the moral character of the people in the republic, citizenry. And basically, the argument of Cicero is that the high old Roman virtue that gave the Roman Republic long-lasting success was grounded in a worldview that embraced natural law. We've looked at a couple of the main ideas, the fundamental ideas of it last time we met. There are five fundamental ideas of natural law. Now, why is this important? I began, the last time we met, Ciceronian ideas are ideas of a well-ordered republic. And the American founders were educated in Cicero. Cicero was a part of education in the 1600s and the 1700s, in the 17th and 18th century. Ciceronian way of rhetoric and speaking and persuasion, as well as thinking. In the opening paragraph of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, the American founders appealed to the, quote, laws of nature and nature's God, natural law, and that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. And then among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Rights are grounded in duties to God, such as the Eighth Commandment of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal. And therefore, Steve has a right to private property because Ryan has a duty before God not to steal what's yours. Our inalienable rights are grounded in duties to God that come first and foremost. This is a Ciceronian way of thinking, okay? But it's a biblical way of thinking. And the American founders were along those same lines, appealing to the laws of nature and nature's God, appealing to natural law. And there are five fundamental ideas of natural law. We looked at the first two, and I'm going to explain a little bit more within the second one today as we move forward. The first fundamental idea of natural law is that the world is an orderly cosmos. It's not chaos, it's cosmos. The world is an orderly cosmos, an orderly system governed by a rational divine providence. Now, I'll just say, in the last 20 years, one of the best translations we have of Cicero's two works, The Republic and the Laws, are by Neil Rudd. He lays out these five as a summary of Cicero's thoughts, and I agree with him wholeheartedly. What I've sought to do, having read his works, is to bring a lots of quotes and substance to say why these are the five fundamental ideas of a natural law view of the world. That the highest law there is, the most fundamental law, is natural law that flows from God Himself. Now, it was Cicero in the Laws. He wrote, the authentic original law, whose function is to command and forbid, is the right reason of Jupiter, Lord of all. Unquote. He believed in the existence of the gods and goddesses of ancient Greece. Rome incorporated lots of those gods and goddesses. you remember, of the Olympian gods and goddesses of ancient Greece, the supreme god was Zeus. The equivalent in Rome, Zeus was given the name Jupiter. And he ascribes to Jupiter rationality, and that Jupiter is the one who has created man and has endowed man with reason. Jupiter is rational, we are rational. Now, this is where, as Christians, we would agree that the world is an orderly cosmos system governed by a rational divine providence, and his name is Yahweh. Exodus 3:14, I am that I am, not Jupiter. But we do believe Yahweh is rational, and in his providence, he governs all things. He has established his throne in the heavens, and his sovereignty rules over all. Psalm 103:19. This is Yahweh. Now, this is where Cicero has an idol in his theology. But his natural law view of these five views Christians would agree with when stated in general terms. Now, what you find, as we pointed out, the world is an orderly cosmos or system governed by a rational divine providence. He has the teleological argument for the existence of a supreme being. The teleological argument, which we have in the evidentiary apologetics, the teleological argument from design, from purpose, and he himself writes about that in the Laws. Every growing thing, Cicero says, seems to have been given to us on purpose. It does not come into existence by chance. The design exists in our world. Another place in the Republic, Cicero states, those who have studied the nature of reality as a whole have realized that this entire world is controlled by one mind. Unquote. You know that the new atheists in our day, such as Richard Dawkins, believe that science is what studies complicated things that merely give the appearance of design. And we as Christians, and Cicero would say, no, you're an idiot. There is real design that exists in this world, and it evidences a designer. It evidences intelligence. It was Cicero who gave the analogy as well in the Republic. He thinks from Plato that if men were shipwrecked on an island and found geometric figures drawn in the sand, they would immediately say, ah, intelligence. There are signs of intellectual activity, and we know it when we see it. And remember, he, Cicero, felt Plato was the greatest philosopher, and Plato mastered Pythagorean thinking. He went to the Pythagoras school in southern Italy after Socrates died. Pythagoras believed all was numbers, all was mathematical. 1 + 1 = 2, and I don't care where you are in the universe. It's not racist, as the sophists in our day like to assert. No, it's reality. Truth is what corresponds to reality. 1 + 1 = 2. And when we see mathematical figures drawn in the sand of our world, it evidences intelligence. And that was the watchword of the founders of modern science, who were all Christians. After Galileo and Copernicus, the watchword was intelligence. They were looking for God's wisdom and design in the world. And it was Cicero as well who said, we've gained much by copying her. The wisdom that's there, that we see, the intelligence that's there. And we've gained countless skills, Cicero says, by nature's teaching. So secondly, a fundamental idea of natural law thinking is that human beings are creatures who exist between the animals and God, sharing reason, law, wisdom, and justice. Cicero in the Laws said this, quote, the creature of foresight, wisdom, variety, keenness, memory, endowed with reason and judgment, which we call man, was created by the supreme God to enjoy a remarkable status. He believed human beings were created by a supreme God. In his mind, the supreme God was Jupiter. But he believed in creation. and that we were endowed by the Supreme God with reason. And we share reason with the rational Supreme God. So in that sense, we're in His image. And the dogs and the cats are not. They don't have reason. Cicero continued, "What is there, I will not say in man, but in the whole of heaven and earth, more divine than reason? A faculty which, when it has developed and become complete, is rightly called wisdom." He goes on, in the Laws, Cicero says, "There is nothing better than reason, and reason is present in both man and God. There is a primordial partnership in reason between man and God. And those who share reason share right reason, since that is law." Now I've included on the board here a little bit more. I want to speak on this and explain concepts of justice, law, and wisdom, and why they're interconnected. And I think as Christians we can gain some wisdom on this when we truly think about this. I brought up some of this when we went through Jerusalem. Western civilization, I believe, begins with Jerusalem, ancient Israel. And then we went through Athens, where republics began, and now we're through the Roman Republic, right, through Rome, and then Rome will be taken over by Christianity, and then we'll go to London, and then eventually to America. But I did bring up in our travels through Jerusalem that God's law, in the Mosaic law, evidences His wisdom. For Cicero, quote, "The origin of justice must be derived from law." The origin of justice must be derived from law. He says, for, quote, "law, whose function is to enjoin right action and to forbid wrongdoing, is wisdom." Unquote. Let's just say we need to be thinking about this, okay? What is law? What is law? As Christians, we believe in the Ten Commandments, summarizing the moral law of God. Well, what is law? Law, its function is to enjoin right action, do this, command us to do certain things, enjoin right action, and to forbid wrongdoing. And when it so does that, it is wisdom. Now, we saw that with ancient Israel in Jerusalem in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 5 through 8. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 5 through 8. Moses writing to them, I'll read this text. "But you who held fast to the Lord your God are alive today, every one of you. Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, the nations around you, who will hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, for whatever reason we may call upon Him? And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before you this day?" Why is law, which truly enjoins right action and forbids wrongdoing, wisdom? Why is law wisdom? Cicero analyzes it using an analysis of both the Greek and Latin words for law. He analyzes both the Greek and Latin words for the term law. The Greek name for law is nomos. And it means, and this is Cicero's words, from giving each his own. Each gets his due, in other words. And the Greek word nemo is related to nomos, and the Greek word nemo means I assign or distribute. I assign or distribute. In addition, the Latin word for law is lex, and it is connected with the word lego in Latin, which refers to choosing. So Cicero says, the Greeks stress the element of fairness in law, and the Romans stress that of choice. And Cicero says, but in fact, each of these is an essential property of law. So the Greeks stress the element of fairness, each getting their due, from each their due, from each to his own. You think of Luke 23:41, the believing thief on the cross, he's speaking to the unbelieving thief, robbers, murderers, hanging next to Christ at the cross. And the believing thief on the cross says, we suffer here justly, getting what we deserve. That's the idea of justice, each getting their due. And this is where justice is derived from law, is what Cicero is saying. But law, what is it? The Greek word nomos, from giving each his own, related with the Greek word nemo, I assign or distribute. The Latin word for law is lex, related with lego, referring to choosing. So Cicero says the Greeks stress the element of fairness in law, each one getting their due, and the Romans stress that of choice. But in fact, each of these is an essential property of law. So for Cicero, inherent in the very name of law is the sense and idea of choosing what is just and right, Cicero says. Choosing, where you assign or distribute, or you choose, the words related to nomos, nemo, and lego to lex, choices are made. Should lying be good or should lying be evil? Should transgenderism be defended or prohibited? Choices are made in law all around us. Should adultery be fine and great and promoted, or should adultery be prohibited and punished? Choices are made in law by the lawgiver. For Cicero, quote, inherent in the very name of law is the sense and idea of choosing what is just and right, unquote. So, in sum then, the wisdom of the lawgiver is evidenced in the law. This is how wisdom is connected with justice in law. The wisdom of the lawgiver is evidenced in the law. Cicero states, quote, as the divine mind is in the highest sense law, so in the case of a human being, when reason is fully developed, that is law. And it is fully developed in the mind of the wise man. Unquote. Read it again. Cicero states, as the divine mind is the highest law, so in the case of a human being, when reason is fully developed, that is law, and it is fully developed in the mind of the wise man. Cicero has said, what is law is right reason. You're choosing what is just and right. Pastor Ron at Grace Baptist Church has said many times, holiness is who God is, righteousness is what God does, and you can as well add, righteousness is what He legislates. It is right. He chooses what is just and right because He is holy. It's the idea from Romans 7:12 that the law is holy and the commandment is holy and righteous and good. Why is God's commandment holy and righteous and good? Because He is holy and righteous and good. The divine mind is the highest law. And God has all wisdom. So he chooses, according to his character, what is just and right. And that is why adultery is wrong and faithfulness in marriage is good. That is why truthfulness is good and lying is evil. So in Cicero's mind, human beings are creatures, the second point, second fundamental idea of natural law, human beings are creatures between the animals and God, sharing divine reason, law, wisdom, and justice. Because they all go together. They all go together. Reason thinks according to the law of non-contradiction. We covered it in Jerusalem. God cannot deny himself. 2 Timothy 2:13. He cannot contradict himself. And therefore, good cannot be evil at the same time or in the same relationship. Why? Divine reason and human reason coinciding with divine reason says so. This is the reality God has created. And because of that, though, what is law? Law is right reason. Enjoining right action and forbidding wrongdoing, which is wisdom. Choosing what is just and right. So justice coincides with it. Third fundamental idea of natural law is that a human being is a distinct species. A human being is a distinct species. Now you can begin to see how they coincide together, where this fits with, we're between the animals and God. We're not animals. We're not pure animals. We've been given reason that we have a primordial sharing of with the supreme divine being who's rational. We're created in his image in a sense. And this is Genesis 1, 26 and 27, where God said, let us make man in our image. He created man, male and female, in his image, in his likeness. We're a distinct species. God created each after their kind, in Genesis 1. Cicero agrees with that assessment. It's not all fluid chaos of an eternal stream of chaos, ever evolving and changing. No. Dogs remain dogs, cats remain cats, humans remain humans. We're a distinct species. It's orderly. It's a system. It's cosmos. And a human being, and remember, being refers to the innermost essence of who we are that does not change. When we speak of human beings, that's what we're talking about. That we have an innermost essence or nature or substance that does not change. You cannot erase it. Any idea of sophist transgenderism is irrational nonsense. Remember, it was the sophists in Athens who caused all their problems, these traveling philosophers, who said that man is the measure. And individual human perception always corresponds to reality. You have your individual perception, I have my individual perception. That's Protagoras. They embraced relativism, subjectivism. Universal words like truth, goodness, evil, beauty are meaningless to them. They're playthings. They don't correspond to reality. All there is change. And you use words and rhetoric to maintain power or achieve certain objectives. Who cares what words you use? And again, I have said, the sophists today exist in the Democrat Party. They're Democrats. But clearly, once the Roman Republic went east of Italy and conquered Greece, many sophists, as we said, traveled to Rome and brought that subjectivism and relativism and made things worse in the Roman Republic when they went to plunder rather than fight wars for national security. Sophism came from Greece at that time and made things worse. Sophist transgenderism is irrational nonsense. It contradicts the reality of nature, human nature. which undercuts the rule of law. This is a key point that I hope you'll see in all of this. If you don't believe that we're a distinct species, you actually cannot believe in the rule of law. How are we all equal under the law if there's no such thing as a human being? Remember, as humans, we are unique as creatures. We are not merely becoming, we change. But we have a fixed, unchanging nature or essence, being. We're both becoming and being. Cicero in the Laws states this, quote, "However one defines man, the same definition applies to us all. There is no essential difference within mankind," unquote. Using the word essential is significant. He's saying the innermost substance and nature and being of who we are, the essence of who we are, no difference. You may be taller than me, I may be shorter than you. I may have more hair than you, you may have less hair than me on my head. You may be older, I may be younger, whatever. We change, we're different in many ways, but we're human beings. Meaning the innermost reality of who you are and who I am is the same. I'll read it again. Cicero states, quote, "However one defines man, the same definition applies to us all. There is no essential difference within mankind," unquote. In the Laws, Cicero continues, quote, "The similarity between human beings is evident in their vices as well as their virtues," unquote. The similarity between human beings is evident in their vices as well as their virtues, unquote. Cicero then provides examples of common human vices and virtues. Here's what Cicero states, quote, "They are all beguiled by pleasure." In other words, we're all deceived by pleasure. It entraps us to do stupid, bad things. "And death," quote, "death is shunned," and, quote, "pain is counted as one of the greatest evils," unquote. He continues, quote, "Troubles and joys, desires and fears haunt the minds of all alike," unquote. He continues, quote, "What community does not love friendliness, generosity, and an appreciative mind which remembers acts of kindness? What community does not reject the arrogant, the wicked, the cruel, and the ungrateful? Yes, and hate them too," unquote. What does the Apostle Paul write to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 10:13? "But there is no temptation that has overcome you, but such as is common to man." But the temptations we face are common to all of us. Now, by His grace, He provides us a way of escape as Christians. That's the argument that Cicero is making along those lines. It evidences we're human beings. And the similarity between human beings is evident in their vices as well as their virtues. Above all, according to Cicero, a human being is a distinct species because he has been endowed by God with reason. Reason is the core of man's unchanging being or essence. You look at the Apostle Paul's modus operandi, where he would go and travel from city to city and go to the synagogues. And what do we see at the beginning of Acts 17? He would reason with them from the Scriptures. Here, let me reason with you that Jesus is the Christ, the anointed one of God, the Messiah, and He's the only Savior, the way to God. In the Laws, Cicero states, quote, "Reason, in fact, the one thing in which we are superior to the beasts, the animals, which enables us to make valid deductions, to argue, refute our opponents, debate, solve problems, draw conclusions, that certainly is common to us all. Unquote. Read it again. This is the essence of reason. All of these things. We're reasoning. We're rational creatures. Cicero says, quote, reason, in fact, the one thing in which we are superior to the beasts, which enables us to make valid deductions, to argue, refute our opponents, debate, solve problems, draw conclusions. That certainly is common to us all. So a human being is a distinct species, rational. Fourth fundamental idea of natural law is that law and justice are based on the objective order of nature, not on man's opinion. Law and justice are based on the objective order of nature, not on man's opinion. This is crucial, especially for our day and age. In the laws, Cicero states, quote, nothing is more vital than the clear realization that we are born for justice and that what is just is based not on opinion, but on nature. Unquote. Now think, nothing is more vital than the clear realization that what is just is based not on opinion, but on nature. Unquote. That what is right, what is fair, is not based on opinion, but on nature. In the laws, Cicero continues, quote, for those who have been endowed by nature with reason have also been endowed with right reason, and hence with law, which is right reason in commanding and forbidding. But if with law, then with justice too. But reason has been bestowed on everybody. Therefore, the same applies to justice. That's where in number two we laid out. Reason, law, wisdom, and justice are all connected. So if we have been endowed with reason, then we have been endowed with right reason, which is law. This is the idea of Romans 2:15. From a Christian worldview perspective, that the Gentiles show the work of the law written in their hearts. Meaning we know what's right, what we should do, and what we should not do. The idea of enjoining right action and forbidding wrong. Law, right reason. We've been endowed with that. But if with law, then with justice too. But reason has been bestowed on everybody, Cicero says, therefore the same applies to justice. Unquote. So think, if law is right reason, given to mankind as a distinct species, sharing reason with the reason of the supreme divine mind, then laws embody justice. They are right and fair if they coincide with divine reason. The supreme God, then, is the ultimate unchanging standard of justice. That's really what he's arguing. In the laws, Cicero states, quote, the origin of justice must be derived from law. The origin of justice must be derived from law. Law depends on how Cicero says, quote, God has created and equipped man. Unquote. Law depends on how God has created and equipped man. Unquote. How has he created us and equipped us? In the laws, Cicero states, quote, there is one single justice. It binds together human society and has been established by one single law. Unquote. Read it again. Cicero said, there is one single justice. It binds together human society and has been established by one single law, unquote, that we all have in common. In the laws, Cicero states, quote, now I included this one because he's addressing libertarians. And he's addressing the social compact theory of government by, for instance, Thomas Hobbes or John Locke. The libertarian argument is along the lines that we form civil society for self-preservation, self-interest, to protect life and property. But that is the main reason, the reason why. Self-preservation to protect life and property. Self-interest. Cicero says, if everything is to be measured by self-interest, then a person will ignore or break the laws if he can, if he thinks it will be to his own advantage. That is why justice is completely non-existent if it is not derived from nature. He's essentially saying, if you don't accept that justice is derived from reality, the way things really are, outside of your mind and my mind, regardless of your self-interest and my self-interest, if you think justice is only a part of self-interest, of what is right, then you're only thinking in terms of your own personal advantage. And then you will ignore the law if it is to your advantage. And we've got people doing it all over our society right now. Read it again. Cicero said, if everything is to be measured by self-interest, then a person will ignore or break the laws if he can, if he thinks it will be to his own advantage. Is it to my advantage to drive 80 down the highway right now? Is it to my advantage to run the stop sign? It might be at times, when I don't really care about you, but me. All self-interest, thinking about myself. Again, if everything is to be measured by self-interest, then a person will ignore or break the laws if he can, if he thinks it will be to his own advantage. That is why justice is completely non-existent if it is not derived from nature, unquote. Is it to my advantage to break the contract that I made? In the laws, Cicero states, quote, what room will there be for liberality, patriotism, and devotion, or for the wish to serve others or to show gratitude? These virtues are rooted in the fact that we are inclined by nature to have a regard for others. And that is the basis of justice, unquote. Read it again. In the law, Cicero states, what room will there be for liberality, patriotism, and devotion, or for the wish to serve others or to show gratitude? These virtues are rooted in the fact that we are inclined by nature to have a regard for others, and that is the basis of justice, unquote. That you're thinking about others when the stop sign comes up, when you face the speed limit sign, when you're looking at the terms of the contract that you agreed to. In the laws, Cicero states, quote, if laws were validated by the orders of peoples, the enactments of politicians, and the verdict of judges, then it would be just to rob, just to commit adultery, just to introduce forged wills, provided those things were approved by the votes or decrees of the populace. Unquote. I'll read it again. And we need to hear this loud and clear in our day. Cicero writes in the laws, if laws were validated by the orders of peoples, the enactments of politicians, and the verdicts of judges, then it would be just to rob, just to commit adultery, and just to introduce forged wills. provided those things were approved by the votes or decrees of the populace. Unquote. It is real interesting to me, in this quote, Cicero refers to three commandments from the second table of the Ten Commandments. The eighth commandment of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal or rob another. So he says, then it would be just to rob. Then it would be just to violate the eighth commandment of the Ten Commandments. The seventh commandment of the Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not commit adultery, which he explicitly refers to. And the ninth commandment of the Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not bear false witness, which is introducing a forged will, bearing false witness. What Cicero is doing is he is arguing that these moral principles are tied to who we are as human beings. It's part of the natural law. Cicero referred to the natural law, quote, as that highest law which came into being countless centuries before any law was written down or any state was even founded, unquote. I'll read it again. Natural law, quote, is that highest law which came into being countless centuries before any law was written down or any state was even founded, unquote. A good book, if you've never read it, in the Christian worldview, is John Murray's book, Principles of Conduct, Aspects of Biblical Ethics. And he argues for the existence of creation ordinances. One example, you know, he's got the sanctity of labor and work, the Sabbath. You think of the Sabbath where the Israelites were to collect double manna on Friday before Saturday, but yet they hadn't been at Mount Sinai yet, so it hadn't even been written down. It's a creation ordinance. God created 6 days, rested the seventh, one in seven to be a day of rest, grounded in creation. But the idea that law is written on the human hearts, tied to who we are as human beings, meaning it existed before any law was ever written down. You see, logically? Russell Kirk, political scientist in the 20th century, he summarized Cicero's view of natural law this way, that law, then, at base, is a knowledge of the ethical norms for the human being. Unquote. What we're into when we speak of natural law is ethics. That these principles are principles of objective ethics. That there is such a thing as right and wrong that exists outside of our minds, tied to the nature of reality, who we are as human beings. And they flow from a supreme God. Cicero states this, because I'm in this topic here of self-interest. Can people vote whatever they want to be? Idea number four, law and justice are based on the objective order of nature, not a man's opinion. Cicero says this, foolish people think they can overturn the nature of things by their votes. Unquote. Foolish people think that they can overturn the nature of things by their votes. Unquote. So if the majority of people want to rob, does that make it okay? If the majority of people want to vote and demand transgenderism, does that mean it's real and reality? No, it does not, right? Foolish people are those who think that they can overturn the nature of things by their votes. Think of it this way. R.C. Sproul talked about it this way once. In our society, surveys are done all the time, right? Put your finger to the wind. What do the majority of people say, right? Or you say you do surveys of what is typical behavior. Do most people lie once a day, you know, or some crazy thing? Or how many people are committing adultery in their marriages? So what's normal? And how do they vote, right? Majority of people vote a certain way. Let's just throw it up to a referendum, right? The progressive movement did that. California has that. You just have everything by referendum. Majority always has their way. Well, What's the assumption behind all of that? The assumption behind all of that is that we can vote whatever we want to be right. Foolish people think that way. They can overturn the nature of things by their votes. In the laws, Cicero states, those who are offenders of the natural law pay a penalty. Those who offend the natural law, these ethical norms, they pay a penalty, not necessarily imposed by courts, Cicero says, which once did not exist anywhere, still do not exist in many places, and where they do exist are often unsound, but they are chased and hounded by the Furies, not with the burning firebrands as in the plays, but with the torment of their own conscience and the agony of their guilt. Unquote. Human beings who offend natural law, they pay a penalty. They're hounded by their guilty conscience. That's what Romans 2:15 says. Romans 2:15, the Gentiles show the work of the law written in their hearts, where their conscience either defends them when they do right or accuses them when they do wrong. The Bible agrees with Cicero's statement there. In the laws, Cicero states, most foolish of all is the belief that everything decreed by the institutions or laws of a particular country is just. Unquote. Read it again. Most foolish of all is the belief that everything decreed by the institutions or laws of a particular country is just. What is he saying? He's saying that there's a standard of right and wrong that is higher than human society. And it judges whether the laws of human society are either just or unjust. What did we do when the American founders declared independence from Great Britain after a long train of abuses in the Declaration of Independence? We appealed to a higher law, the laws of nature and nature's God, that stands over the King of England. There is a higher law eternally tied to the right reason of God Himself, and that is the natural law. And it is the standard of what is just for any human society. Human beings cannot revoke it, change it, annul it, or abolish it. It is inalienable to who we are as human beings. In other words, the civil laws of any human society are just laws only if they coincide with the immutable natural laws. Law and justice are based on the objective order of nature, not on man's opinion. And point five, the fundamental fifth idea of natural law is that human moral excellence can only be realized in communities. Human moral excellence can only be realized in communities. None of us are lone rangers. You can be ethical out in your log cabin somewhere all by yourself. I understand that. But moral excellence can only be achieved in community. In Christianity, in the biblical worldview, the Greek word for the church is the ecclesia. What does that mean? The called together ones. Called out of the world, called together, is that we need one another to achieve moral excellence, to be sanctified and conformed into the image of Christ. We need one another. Part of that is civil society. Part of it's civil society. That you have neighbors. That I have neighbors. It's a good thing. In the laws, echoing Aristotle's thoughts, Cicero states, quote, moral excellence is nothing more than the completion and perfection of nature, unquote. Moral excellence is nothing more than the completion and perfection of nature, unquote. Now you remember when we went through Plato and Aristotle, Plato had this view of two different worlds, the physical world, the shadowy world that we live in, that is copies of the spiritual perfect world of forms. Aristotle put them together and said the form of something is in it, not existing in some separate world. The forms of dogs is in dogs, and the forms of cats is in cats. And the idea is that the acorn will turn into the oak tree. The form is there of oakness in the acorn. And moral excellence is nothing more than the completion and perfection of nature, of that morally, the acorn becoming the oak tree. In the Republic, also echoing Aristotle's thoughts, Cicero states, quote, moral excellence is entirely a matter of practice. Its most important field of practice, moreover, is in the government of a state. Unquote. Aristotle had a lot of saying, how is it that we achieve moral excellence in life? And it is through developing good habits. Aristotle had a lot of that through practice. And then that develops character in his mind, that you get up and you're bent a certain way to read your Bible right away and pray. You develop the habit, and then you're bent that way, and you don't feel right unless you do it. And Aristotle had an observation about ethics, that it's kind of the way we are as human beings. In Cicero's view, the most important field of practice is in the government of a state. Practicing good behavior within citizenry, being a good neighbor and a good citizen. In the Republic, Cicero states, quote, nor indeed is there any occupation which brings human excellence closer to divine power than founding new states and preserving those already founded, unquote. We were given the dominion mandate when God created mankind to have dominion over the creatures, delegated authority. We're his vice regent in this world. Now you remember, he's one who had been as well a governor of a province, one of the provinces in the Roman Republic, but he had been a consul, one of the top positions in the Roman Republic, making many administrative decisions. Cicero agrees then with Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle that human beings are by nature social creatures, which I wrote on the board there. That's essentially what he's saying, is we are by nature social creatures. It's not really out of weakness, but that we are bent and inclined to come together as a civil society. We're by nature social creatures. In the Republic, Cicero states this, well then, a republic is the property of the public. What is a republic? They were a Roman republic. Republic. So his definition is, what is a republic? Well then, a republic is the property of the public. He says, but a public is not every kind of human gathering, congregating in any manner, but a numerous gathering brought together by legal consent and a community of interest. Cicero continues, the primary reason for its coming together is not so much weakness as a sort of innate desire on the part of human beings to form communities. Unquote. But a sort of innate desire on the part of human beings to form communities. We have an innate desire. We're wired this way to form communities. We're social creatures. Now, that's not libertarianism. Libertarianism views all communities as social constructs. They can be anything because we are not by nature social. So we can will any arrangement we want contractually. So when you get married, write your own wedding vows. Now, as Christians, we say, no, we're by nature social creatures, and God created marriage. He sets the terms of the arrangement, what the duties and responsibilities and privileges are between husband and wife. We're by nature social creatures, and God is the one who sets the terms of these arrangements, right? But brought together by legal consent to community of interest, when we look across society, we know that individual human beings have unequal wealth and abilities. So what holds them together in the polis, in the city-state, in civil society? What holds us all together? Victor Davis Hanson said, what is citizenship? Larry Arn, president of Hillsdale, same thing. What is citizenship? Citizens are committed to the common good, is the way they typically phrase it. Committed to the common good. In the Republic, Cicero states, quote, law is the bond which holds together a community of citizens, and the justice embodied in the law is the same for everyone, unquote. If I asked you and said, what is it that defines what's good? The law. Ultimately, natural law, God's law. That robbing is sinful and bad and wicked. Adultery is sinful and bad and wicked. Introducing forged wills are sinful and bad and wicked. Why? The natural law says so, from the supreme God. In the Republic, Cicero states, law is the bond which holds together a community of citizens, and the justice embodied in the law is the same for everyone. This is the idea of the rule of law. Think about it. All who steal, for example, will be punished by the law, which defines what is right and what they deserve, regardless of whether they're wealthy or poor, regardless whether they have great abilities or few. Equal justice under the law. There shouldn't be a two-tier justice system. Cicero says, law is the bond which holds together a community of citizens, and the justice embodied in the law is the same for everyone. So the law addresses every single citizen as a human being, treating each equally, since the innermost reality of who we are is the same. There is no essential difference between us. We're a distinct species. We're not brute beasts. The essence of who we are is the same. Whatever definition applies to human being applies to us all. So therefore, the law that addresses us all equally. If we are in political communities, bonded together by laws that truly display justice, consistent with the natural law, then human beings can move closer to moral excellence. If we are in political communities bonded together by laws that truly display justice, consistent with natural law, human beings then can move closer to moral excellence. It's essentially his argument. Now, what I want you to see is that Cicero arrived at his understanding of natural law by both Greek philosophy. And remember, the pre-Socratics, Cicero loved Plato, right? Plato studied Socrates. He was a student of Socrates. Socrates died 399. Socrates was the first Greek political philosopher. He started political philosophy, starting ethics and studying the polis. All of those before Socrates were pre-Socratics, and philosophy meant science. Science. Being scientific. Studying the things that have been made, Romans 1:20. So he arrived at his understanding of natural law by Greek philosophy and the legal history of Rome's Republic, by being scientific and studying the Greek thinkers as they were scientific, but as well the legal history of Rome's Republic. This is just as important. When you read his writings, what you see is that he shows his great depth of history of the Roman Republic. He talks a lot about their legal history. He goes into the 12 tables that we looked at that were there after the start of the Roman Republic in 509 BC, and then it went into the 400s. The plebs got an assembly, and then the plebs demanded a written statutory code, and they had 10 representatives. Some of them went to Greece, brought back some examples from Ceylon, and they wrote the 12 tables around 451 BC, but he goes into this whole history of things, okay? The legal history of Rome's Republic. How Rome developed its understanding of law within the Republic is what brought about an understanding of natural law. Okay? this is very important to see. Now, there are three bodies of law that arose in the Roman Republic. We just talked about the natural law with those five fundamental ideas, right? In Latin, the jus natural, in Latin, the natural law is supreme over all and encompasses the entire issue of universal justice and law. That's what we were just looking at. Who are we as human beings? We're rational beings. We're between God and the animals. We share right reason with God Himself, the supreme God. And therefore, we share law, justice, and wisdom. We're a distinct species, and justice is tied to the order of things, right? And we achieve moral excellence in community, where law is put together, right? Well, natural law is above it all. Defines what's just for a civil society. The highest standard that judges what's right and wrong for our civil society. Ethical norms. Well, as well, another body of law developed the law of nations. The law of nations. And in Latin, the jus gentium. The law of nations refers to the laws by which states ought to be governed. It's not referring to international law. Don't think of it that way. But it's referring to the laws by which states ought to be governed. The specific laws by which states ought to be governed. And a third body of law within the Roman Republic was civil law, jus civile in Latin, refers to, quote, the laws and enactments which peoples have compiled and written down. Okay, so Cicero arrived at his understanding of natural law, certainly by studying Greek philosophy. They're referred to many times in his writings. And as well, the legal history of Rome's Republic. This is very important, okay? And you'll see why, I hope, by the time we're done. When asked at the beginning of the laws, tell us your opinion about civil law. I said he writes in Plato's style in the laws and in the Republic with a dialogue. And he's there with different people and there's a dialogue taking place. Tell us your opinions about civil law. This is what Cicero states at the beginning of his book, The Laws. Quote, but in our present analysis, we have to encompass the entire issue of universal justice in law. That's natural law. Now, they asked, tell us your opinions about civil law. Civil law is all of the particular laws and statutes of our civil society, of the Roman Republic. Tell us your opinions about civil law. And he says, but in our present analysis, we have to encompass the entire issue of universal justice and law. What we call civil law will be confined to a narrow, small corner of it. We must clarify the nature of justice, and that has to be deduced from the nature of man. That's the five things we looked at. Then we must consider the laws by which states ought to be governed. That's the law of nations. And then finally, with the laws and enactments which peoples have compiled and written down, what we call the civil law. So for Cicero, then, the natural law, the jus natural in Latin, is supreme over all, and it encompasses the entire issue of universal justice and law. We just discussed it. Then there are the laws by which states ought to be governed, referred to as the law of nations, the jus gentium in Latin. And finally, there are the laws and enactments which peoples have compiled and written down, referred to as the civil law, jus civile in Latin. Now, it is here that we see Greek philosophy was necessary for Cicero to arrive at his understanding of natural law, but it was not sufficient. The legal history of Rome before Cicero's lifetime, he lived again 106 to 43 BC, the legal history of Rome before Cicero's lifetime was also necessary for Cicero to arrive at his understanding of natural law. And Cicero provides deep, in-depth sketches of that legal history in both the Republic and the Laws. Now, you remember that the Roman Republic did not get control of all of ancient Italy until the early 3rd century BC, till the upper 200s BC. So it kept conquering more and more land in more and more areas. And in that period of time, it waged war from mid-300s to mid-200s for that 100-year span. It waged war every year, basically, for security. And in Italy, then, it kept spreading out its jurisdiction and control. But it didn't take control of all of Italy until the early 3rd century B.C. So the Roman Republic was founded 509 B.C. The kingdom period had conquered some land around Rome. Okay, so when the Republic was formed, it had those, and then it kept warring against others in Italy, across Italy, gaining more and more territory. Well, before that point, before they gained control of all of Italy, the Roman people knew only the civil law for Roman citizens. Russell Kirk states that the civil law at that time was a complex body of customary laws, not ordinarily promulgated through formal enactment by Senate and people, but rather developing out of long usage among the Romans themselves. You remember the 12 tables didn't take place until the mid-5th century. About 50 years after the Roman Republic was founded, the plebes were like, we want written statutes here, and they ended up with the 12 tables to kind of give them clear direction, right? Well, from that point on, there's a lot that was customary ways of doing things. And the civil law involved a lot of those customary things. It wasn't always through formal enactment. But that's really what the people knew before they got control of all of Italy and the Roman Republic. The civil laws that they knew were mainly customary things. It resembles, Russell Kirk says, the English common law. And we'll cover that, Lord willing, up ahead after Rome when we get to London. By the way, every lawyer in this land, except for those in Louisiana, is tested in the bar exam on common law. Many bodies of law, tort law, personal injury law, contract law, property law, are under common law. So we inherited that from England. Louisiana has a French history. The French tried to statutorialize everything. So in Louisiana, they don't have the common law. So every lawyer, though, in the other states, we inherited from England the common law. So when I took the bar exam in Indiana to become a lawyer in 2002, a third of the exam was the common law. And it is a multi-state portion. It's the same part of Minnesota's, even. So a third of Minnesota's was the common law, the multi-state. Minnesota had a rule, if you scored high enough on that, you could wave right in. So by the grace of God, I did, and I am licensed to practice law in Minnesota and Indiana solely because I scored so high on the common law portion. I loved studying that portion. But the common law developed from cases and controversies, judges. You don't look to statutory code. You remember when the Normans defeated the Saxons, Middle Ages, came across the English Channel from France and defeated the Saxons, the king set up king's courts across the land. And the king's courts began ruling on contract issues or personal injury issues. It wasn't statutory code, but they, from the canon law lawyers of the Catholic Church, they had principles to go by, biblical principles to go by, to help them dealing with contract issues, dealing with property law issues, dealing with personal injury issues. And then they would stare decisis, stand decision, literally. Let the decision stand. So that case precedent. So they would look to prior cases. When has a judge ruled on this, on a similar fact pattern with a similar law, and then a body of consistent, rational, logical law began to form? By court cases. So to understand what's in a common law rule, a legal rule, you have to do research in court cases. That's where it is. And then you summarize, they get summarized in horn books of what those laws are from court cases. That's kind of what was developed within the Roman Republic, within various cases and controversies by judges. In the Roman Republic, as this body of laws increased in complexity, it was regularized to some extent by annual edicts by praetors. Praetors were like chief judicial officers of Rome. You could think of them, Russell Kirk says, like Roman chief justices. So the praetors, the chief justices, would kind of regularize certain decisions that were made in the Roman Republic to make them consistent, in a sense. One scholar, Neil Rudd, he says in 366 BC, the name praetor was attached to a newly instituted legal official who had to be a patrician. Remember, there were patricians and plebes. Patricians were the landowning wealthy. But he was elected by the assembly of centuries. Remember, that was how the Roman military was divided up into centuries. So it was the military that elected then who this praetor or chief judicial officer would be. But then they would kind of regularize the various decisions that had been made. And as Rome grew in size, the Roman Republic grew in size, the number of praetors increased. The number of these judicial officers increased. But that's like the king's courts in England. Judges, praetors, judges, chief justices then would kind of systematize logically their decisions over time. But once the Roman Republic extended its jurisdiction over the whole of Italy, then by the early 3rd century BC, it became necessary to recognize, indeed to create, a second body of laws applicable to the multitudes of people who were not full Roman citizens. They were not entitled either then to full privileges of Romans. Rome kept enlarging in size with more military victories across Italy, bringing in non-Romans who were not used to Roman civil law, who were not granted full Roman citizenship. What do you do with them? They developed another body of law to deal with them. And this is the law of nations then, the jus gentium, the laws by which states ought to be governed. You remember, just a little review for you. I covered this, but it's good to review this at this point. You remember that after 338 BC, the Roman Republic won the Latin War against other Latin colonies in Italy. So they were expanding the Republic outward across Italy. The Roman Senate decided at that point to classify all cities by their various relationships to Rome, not by their own ethnicity or uniqueness. But it was a change that took place. And this is how they were able to maintain jurisdiction over vast areas, because they then changed how they looked at these other conquered areas. The Roman Senate at that point, after 338 BC, decided to classify all cities by their various relationships to Rome. In that new policy, you remember that some newly acquired territories were granted non-voting citizenship, which was a new invention. Say, we'll grant you citizenship, but it'll be non-voting, which had never been done before. Other cities that had been conquered across Italy were Latin colonies that remained quasi-independent, but were under the umbrella of the Roman Republic's jurisdiction. These Latin colonies that were kind of quasi-independent, they retained their traditional Latin rights that we covered, concubium, of the right to marry a Roman citizen, commercium, the right to trade and conduct business with Rome, and migration, the right to move around areas controlled by Rome. But these quasi-independent Latin colonies were neither full citizens nor partial citizens of the Roman Republic. But yet under the umbrella of Rome's jurisdiction, we conquered you, but we're not granting you non-voting citizenship nor citizenship, but you're in a forced alliance with us and in somewhat under our authority. So a new body of laws were developed to deal with that situation, and that was the jus gentium, the law of nations. And it's not international law, but instead it's a body of legal rules founded upon customs more or less common to non-Roman peoples. So they looked at all of these Latin groups that were not granted full citizenship, not granted partial non-voting citizenship, but were yet under Rome's thumb of control. They developed a body of legal rules that, in a sense, regularized their customs. A second judicial officer, a praetor peregrinus, or judge for strangers or foreigners, had jurisdiction over such cases. So remember, you think, how is it that Rome became so massive and large and controlled at one point, you know, at the time of Christ, it's controlling everything from Great Britain, across Western Europe, across all areas of the Mediterranean. Italy, Greece, Asia Minor, Palestine, and part of Asia there, and across Egypt, North Africa. How did it control all of that? Remember how they dealt with Israel. Sometimes they had what we called municipality, where they let the local people govern their own affairs, but they were still under Roman law. Remember the Sanhedrin still governed in Israel at the time of Christ. The 70-member council, the Supreme Court of Israel still governed, but they couldn't put anybody to death. They had to go get permission from who? Pilate, Roman governor, right? From Rome, they had to get permission because they're under the jurisdiction umbrella of Rome, ultimately. So this is how Rome was able to conquer people, but yet not make them all full Roman citizens, not even partial citizens with non-voting status. But this is where they appointed across Italy, when they were doing this across Italy, expanding, then they added a second judicial officer, a judge for foreigners or strangers to deal with cases involving these Latin colonies that they conquered, but yet did not technically directly absorb into the Roman Republic. Not granted full citizenship, not even non-voting citizenship. It's from the work of those Roman judges over foreigners within the Republic's jurisdiction, pondering universal underlying principles of justice and fairness within the prevailing customs and laws of these foreigners, that a third body of laws then arose from that, the natural law, jus naturae. Russell Kirk puts the difficult task this way for these judges over strangers or foreigners. Yet in many instances, it was found difficult to reconcile the differing forms of law prevailing among various foreign peoples, or to make those forms agree tolerably well with the Roman civil law. So what if you had Latin colony A and Latin colony B and Latin colony C? You've conquered them in Italy, but they're not directly a part of Rome. You know, in a sense, they're not given full Roman citizenship. They're not giving non-voting citizenship. But yet they're under the jurisdiction of Rome. What if a citizen of Latin colony A has a beef with citizen of Latin colony C? And then they go to court. Who hears their dispute? This Roman judge for strangers, for foreigners. And he's got to figure out and think through their various customs that seem at times not always to coincide with one another. So then the judge then is looking for underlying principles of justice and equity and fairness. The praetors had to search for principles of justice that would apply reasonably in these cases of differing legal systems. Principles founded upon ethical norms, the general opinion of mankind, and the nature of rational man, upon theories of universal justice. How do we rule over these people that have legal disputes? Well, this is where they begin to ponder the natural law. Universal principles of justice and fairness. What's right if these people have a contractual dispute, but there's different customs and laws? So the Ciceronian understanding of natural law for the Roman Republic boils down to this, that human laws are only copies of eternal laws when they are just and right, and those eternal laws are peculiar to man, for only man on earth is a rational being. And the test of validity for the state's laws is their conformity to reason. He doesn't have the Bible, but they can understand adultery is wrong. Introducing forged wills are wrong. Robbing is wrong. So these judges had to look for principles on ethical norms based on the nature of mankind, theories of universal justice, and that's where the natural law began to develop and form under that. He's a lawyer, one of the leading lawyers of his day, understanding this legal history, not just Greek philosophy. As we discussed, Cicero believed that man is a distinct species who shares right reason with the supreme divine being, and thus shares both law and justice with the supreme divine being. That law is right reason. It forbids what is evil, commands what is good, because they are tied to the order of objective reality flowing from the rational supreme divine being. Another way to think about it, Russell Kirk puts it this way. This is another way of stating it. Natural law is the interpretation of customary or positive law in the light of general ethical principles. Natural law is not a written code, but rather a means for doing justice by referring to the general norms for mankind. Unquote. I want you to chew on that one a minute. We covered, when we went through Jerusalem, the New Testament view in Romans 13, 1 through 10, and how we today should be looking at the Mosaic Law. And we look clearly at the Westminster Confession of Faith from the 1640s AD. Now you remember the Old Testament Mosaic Law, there's three aspects of it. The ceremonial law, we know that's fulfilled in Christ. There's the moral law, summarized in the Ten Commandments. 10 very general moral principles. And remember, Martin Luther and John Calvin believe the Ten Commandments are written in human hearts. Romans 2:15. What law is that? They believed it was the Ten Commandments. And remember, the Ten Commandments, written on human hearts, do not include a redemptive preface. That's only for Israel, who was redeemed from Egypt. That I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the house of slavery, out of the land of Egypt. That redemptive preface is not the Ten Commandments. That redemptive preface is for Israel. Ten Commandments starts with, thou shalt have no other gods before me. The judicial law or civil law, when we went through and looked at the specific statutes and ordinances written out for the ancient agricultural society of Israel, the view of the Westminster Confession of Faith and the biblical view is that you and I only look to the specific statutes and ordinances that relate to the second table of the Ten Commandments on neighborly relations. Why is that? Because Romans 13, 1 through 10, laying out the prescription for civil government for Gentile nations today, the Apostle Paul in Romans 13, 9 only refers to examples from the second table of the Ten Commandments. Romans 13, 9, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there is any other commandment, it's subordinate in this, thou shalt love your neighbors yourself. Only dealing with neighborly relations. The Apostle Paul knew full well Jesus' summary of the first table, love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. He excludes that in Romans 13, 1 through 10. Why? Because Gentile civil governments, God hates forced worship. He wants free exercise of religion. That's Roger Williams. We've covered him too as well. Founded Providence, Rhode Island. Forced worship stinks in God's nostrils, Roger Williams said. His view and the view of the Quakers became the view of the First Amendment. That Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So the role of the civil government, of Gentile civil governments in our day, is to criminalize sins of the second table, neighborly relations, and defend the free exercise of religion under the first table. And how then do we look then at the Mosaic law, ceremonial law fulfilled in Christ? Does not apply to today. Anything there regarding the animal sacrifices and the religious festivals, all of that ceremonial law, dietary issues, all of that fulfilled in Christ. All of that, the specific statutes and ordinances relating with the first table of the Ten Commandments, that was binding on Israel. Why? Because they were in a voluntary covenant with God. All of the people said, all that God has said we will do. It was voluntary. They were in a covenant, redemptive relationship with God, therefore criminalized sins of both tables it was criminal to violate the Sabbath, to blaspheme God's name. Here in America, under the First Amendment, we do not criminalize sins of the first table. We criminalize sins of the second table. Remember, we started out the shining city on a hill in Massachusetts, colonial Massachusetts. Where did they come from? Union of church and state in England. What did they have? Union of church and state. So they were criminalizing sins of the first table and the second table. That's what Roger Williams protested against. They were going to put him to death, and they granted mercy and let him migrate out of there, emigrate out, and he went south and founded Providence Plantation. Under the idea that we will only criminalize sins of the second table, and we will defend religious freedom under the first table. And only if your free exercise of religion on the first table intrudes upon the second table will we restrain it. You start disrupting my private property because of your free exercise of religion, we're going to restrain you. Or you start at human sacrifices, murdering, we're going to restrain you. We're going to prohibit it. Okay? That's not going to be allowed under the free exercise of religion. But what's key is this. We covered it. It's in the Westminster Confession of Faith. How do we handle, then, looking at the Mosaic Law on neighborly relations? We go there to look for the underlying principles of justice and fairness are binding today. The underlying principles of justice and fairness in neighborly relations in the Mosaic Law are binding today. God was king. He wrote and applied the general Ten Commandments to their unique ancient agricultural society. His wisdom was shown in the civil law, the judicial law of Israel. But the underlying principles of justice and fairness are embodied in the Ten Commandments. And those are principles that we look to then that are binding today as we study the Mosaic Law and neighborly relations. Remember, in the Ten Commandments, it was Dr. Dan Block, one of Pastor Ron's professors, professor of Old Testament. He said that the Ten Commandments are so general, they cannot be enforced in a court of law. There are 10 general, very general moral principles that are so general, they cannot be enforced in a court of law. What do you mean by stealing or adultery? We need specifics. It fails for vagueness. Okay? That's what Cicero is getting at, saying that it's not statutory. It's not written out. Now, we can say God, with his finger, wrote the Ten Commandments, the very general principles, but they're so general they cannot be enforced in a court of law. It takes a wise lawgiver to take those general principles and apply them to the unique circumstances of your society. And that's what God did as king for ancient Israel. So he did it for the first table and the second table. But you and I look to the Mosaic Law regarding the second table based on Romans 13, 1 through 10. Romans 13, 9 only includes examples from the second table. And we then look and say, this is how God applied thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, how he applied it to the specifics in his wisdom of the ancient agricultural society of Israel. And then we can look and look for the underlying principles of justice and fairness and say, they're binding today. One of the biggest problems I have is Christians who don't want to study the Mosaic Law. I say, well, what are you legislating with? Remember, I've said, you believe bestiality is sinful and should be criminal? Where in the New Testament is it? It's not. You have to go to the Old Testament Mosaic Law to say that bestiality is sinful and should be criminal. How about abortion? Where in the New Testament? Show me in the New Testament where it should be sinful and criminal. It's not. You have to go to the Old Testament Mosaic Law. And we can go on down the list. Many examples. That's where we have to go to. And remember, it's 1 Samuel 8:7, where the Israelites wanted their earthly king. And God told Samuel, don't worry about it, they've rejected me as their king. God was their king. He, in his wisdom, applied the very general Ten Commandments, the very ten general moral principles to their specifics of their ancient agricultural society. But this is this idea then of the judges for foreigners were looking at these different statutory codes and civil laws of these peoples, groups in Italy that they conquered and saying, I got a rule on these cases, but they don't seem to square somewhat. Well, there's got to be some underlying principles of justice and fairness that we can grasp and make rulings on this. And this is what led them to a view of natural law, that there are underlying principles of justice and fairness, universal principles of justice tied to who we are as human beings. That I don't care whether you're Latin colony A, B, C, or D. They apply to all of us. And that's the same. We find them, we look at ancient Israel, we can find them there as well. And they're binding on you and I today. And we can gain wisdom because we can see, oh, this is how God applied it to their unique situation. It may be applied differently to ours in our 21st century AD, but we can gain wisdom as to how to do it. How significant for Western civilization is Cicero's understanding of natural law that crystallized in legal form during the Roman Republic? How significant is it for Western civilization? Even after the Roman Republic fell, it continued on in the Roman Empire. Even after Christ and the eclipse of paganism by Christianity, the Ciceronian idea of natural law continued. This is what Russell Kirk states. Through the Catholic Church and the medieval schoolmen, and especially through the work of the Bologna doctors of law, they were the professors of law in Italy in the Middle Ages, as well as through Thomas Aquinas, Ciceronian natural law dominated legal theory on down to the 17th century AD. In Southern Europe, these natural law theories reemerged after the Dark Ages of disorder. In the fullness of time, the natural law element in Roman law would prevail in Northern Europe, and through a subtle process of infiltration would work even upon the independent common law of England, though English kings tried to keep out Roman theories. But within the common law of England, the judges were referred to equity. What they meant is justice when they referred to that, not the idiocy we have today when they refer to equity under DEI. So the Ciceronian idea of natural law went all the way through the Catholic Church continued with it, Thomas Aquinas, the various doctors and professors of law in Italy, in Bologna, Italy, all the way through into Southern Europe and Northern Europe. But really, the real reason it continued on is because it's consistent with biblical Judeo-Christianity, our understanding of the world, that those five fundamental things of natural law we would agree with. But it's not Jupiter, it's Yahweh that is the supreme God and the only true and living God. Truth is what corresponds to reality, and Cicero's description of the natural law as understood in the Roman Republic described reality truthfully, except regarding the character of God. The identity of the supreme God, he failed. And he embraced a lie. He embraced idolatry as to the identity of the supreme God. He claimed it was Jupiter. But the five fundamental ideas of his natural law worldview all fit consistently with the biblical Judeo-Christian view of the world. And that's why it continued on in Western civilization and dominated. Now, Cicero lived during a lawless period at the end of the Roman Republic, as we have described. Does it mean he was a revolutionary? Does it mean he was a revolutionary? What he's saying and arguing, just like we as Christians, is that there is a law higher than any civil government. And it is the standard for judging whether your laws are good or bad. Remember, it's foolish to think that you can vote against nature, that you can make whatever you want to be just. It's not determined by a majority vote. It's not. There's a standard. It's higher, and it's embodied in the natural law, laid down by the supreme God of heaven and earth. So does that mean you're a revolutionary to believe in it? You could say then, it's a standard to judge and say, this is a corrupt government. It needs to be overturned. I'll just say, just as a side note, when Justice Clarence Thomas was up for a nomination to the Supreme Court, Biden was on the Judiciary Committee and absolutely ridiculed Clarence Thomas for believing in natural law. Those who ridicule natural law are foolish people who think that the verdict of judges or the enactments of politicians make things just. They think there's no higher authority than themselves. Utter foolishness. And Cicero would agree. But Cicero was no revolutionary. No, he understood the natural law. He understood that the law of nature is superior to the civil law and the law of nations. It's superior to the praetor's edict. It's superior to the commands of Caesar. The natural law is superior to any human government ruler. God's law is supreme, tied to the nature of reality God created. The law of the state ought to be consistent with the law of nature. And you and I can appeal from the injustice of any civil government to you and I. We can appeal to the laws of nature and nature's God, as America's founders did in the preface to the Declaration of Independence in 1776. Cicero was a statesman and a lawyer in the Roman Republic, and as Russell Kirk notes, Cicero was strongly attached to tradition and precedent. He was a man of constitutionality and order. He had a conservative mindset. When you read his writings, you can see it. You know, we've noted he wrote at a time when he wrote the Republic and the Laws between 55 and 51 BC. Cicero had seen and experienced lawfare, gang violence, assassinations, personal exile, corruption among the consuls and governing people. The Roman Republic was falling into violent lawlessness and disorder. Cicero wanted the Roman Republic to return to the glorious constitutional order of its history, its past, when it once expounded and governed according to the general ethical principles of the natural law. We had a past when we did that too in our country. So in the lawless days in which he lived, Cicero appealed to the natural law, just like the American founders did in 1776. Russell Kirk described Cicero's anti-revolutionary conservative stance regarding the natural law this way. Yet in times of sharp crisis, the true legality of governors may be tested by repairing to the natural law. If a dictator like Caesar or a body of oligarchs like the first and second military triumvirates against which Cicero contended, if they flouted or overthrew the constitution of a state, then their decrees do not have the moral force of law. If the temporary masters of a state are unjust, if they act contrary to the law of nature, men possessing right reason then are under no moral obligation to obey them. The same test of natural law applies to any form of democratic mob. In the Republic, Cicero states this, and in times of civil conflict, when soundness, what he meant is virtue, can be translated virtue, when soundness or virtue is more important than numbers, I think citizens should be assessed rather than counted. Unquote. Are you virtuous or not? By the standard of natural law. Don't just take a poll as if whatever the majority says, well, I guess that's what's right. Cicero states, and in times of civil conflict, when soundness, when virtue is more important than numbers, I think citizens should be assessed rather than counted. We have to have a discussion about universal justice. What is ultimately right and wrong? The ethical virtue of the eternal natural law is most important, since it is the highest authority. So Russell Kirk says, summarizing Cicero, the crowd too may act illegally and unjustly. One appeals from mob rule to that eternal law which is of divine inspiration. Unquote. So there was always this tension between virtue and power. What's virtuous? Are the people exercising power virtuous or not? Are they consistent with natural law or not? Are they unjust or just? And I read it before, I'll read it again from Cicero. It's so important. Cicero in the Laws says, if laws were validated by the orders of peoples, the enactments of politicians, and the verdicts of judges, then it would be just to rob, just to commit adultery, just to introduce forged wills, provided those things were approved by the votes or decrees of the populace. The specific laws of any human society, whether a monarchy, an aristocracy, or a democracy, or a mixture of them, which is a republic. The laws of any human society, the civil laws of any human society, are only valid if derived from the general eternal ethical principles of natural law. Now, his whole goal was to bring about peace and to bring about harmony within the Roman Republic. He knew everything was in chaos. The Roman Republic refused to listen to his wisdom, though. You've heard the saying, beware the Ides of March. Well, it was in March of 44 BC that the military dictator Julius Caesar died at the hands of a group of Roman senators. Russell Kirk describes it this way, that after Caesar was murdered, Cicero struggled to restore the constitution of the Roman Republic, denouncing Mark Antony in the Senate and trying to unite the provincial governors in their resistance to the second military triumvirate that had succeeded Caesar. At last, Cicero was condemned by Mark Antony and his colleagues, though Octavian, who was later Augustus, tried to remove Cicero's name from the list of the condemned. So it's interesting that those in the Senate, Mark Antony and others, had condemned Cicero and his colleagues. They were trying to get united resistance from the provincial governors against this usurpation of power. And Octavian, later Augustus, who was the first emperor of the Roman Empire, at the time, he tried to remove Cicero's name from the list of the condemned. He was on Cicero's side, but he was unsuccessful. Mark Antony's soldiers sought out Cicero at his seaside villa in December of 43 BC, and Russell Kirk says, ran him through. They carried his severed head and hands to the profligate adventurer Antony, whom they found at an election in the forum, and put Cicero's severed heads and hands on stakes. With Cicero fell the Republic, is the way Russell Kirk describes it. After Cicero's death in 43 BC, the Roman Empire was formed in 31 BC when Augustus won a decisive battle, being formally recognized in 27 BC by the Senate as the first Roman emperor. Significantly, Russell Kirk notes, years later, Augustus, first of the emperors, found his little grandson reading one of Cicero's books and said to him, quote, my child, this was a learned man and a lover of his country, unquote. Indeed, Cicero was, whereas the American founders chose to listen to Cicero's wisdom, the Roman Republic refused. Lord willing, the next time we meet, we're going to discuss some of the Roman Empire, probably some on Stoicism that was prevalent at that time. And then we'll move into the arrival of the Lord Jesus Christ in Christianity and move on from there and with Rome. So Lord willing, that's kind of the plan of where we're going. And then, Lord willing, eventually we'll go through London to America.